In just a moment, the makers of Florida Malva, the Cigar Supreme, bring you Irving Waugh and the World in Review. How many of you men know the Malva family tree has more than three generations of discriminating smokers? Yes, indeed, cigar smokers enjoyed the luxury of a Malva cigar way back in the gay 90s. And all you have to do is look around you to find out how many men are enjoying Malvas today. If you aren't one of the host of men who consider Malva their favorite cigar, try one and see for yourself. Walk into your nearest cigar store and say, "Make mine Malva." Ah, you're due for some real deep-down smoking satisfaction with Malva, spelled M-E-L-V-A. Now, Irving Waugh and the World in Review.
President Truman has again appealed to China to end her civil war, and again he has held out an offer of American economic aid when hostilities cease. The president took the opportunity of using his press conference this afternoon to publicize his views on the Far Eastern situation. He said that General George Marshall, his special ambassador, will remain in China until his job is finished. This was the president's answer to the rumors that had been having the former chief of staff returning to this country. General Marshall took the China assignment because he was asked to do so in the realization that the job was a most difficult one with little chance of success. The general is past the retirement age and would have preferred to spend his time on his Virginia estate, a rest that he has well earned. But he accepted the China post and has made every attempt to bring some order out of the Chinese fire. And from the president's remarks today, apparently has not yet abandoned all hope of salvaging something that will bring some measure of peace to the long devastated country. In his review of the China case, Mr. Truman pledged that the United States will not interfere in China's internal affairs. That's presumed that the president means by that this country will not attempt to play any part in Chinese affairs other than attempting to bring the two factions that are at loggerheads together. We can look upon our actions in this regard as being beneficial for the Chinese people and justify our moves accordingly. And from our point of view, it is a justifiable bit of meddling. But the Russians take a very different view of the whole matter. Moscow accuses the United States of supporting the nationalist against their favorites, the communists. And in the Soviet eyes, we are strictly interfering in the internal affairs of the Chinese. Mr. Truman reiterated in his statement this afternoon that the United States believes that a united and democratic China is of the utmost importance to world peace. He said China has a clear responsibility to the other United Nations to eliminate armed conflict within its own territory as constituting a threat to world stability and to peace. He expressed deep regret that China has as yet been unable to unite internally through peaceful methods. The president pointed out that General Marshall has remained in China even though active peace negotiations have been broken off for the communists. And he declared, "We are ready to help China as she moves toward peace and genuine democratic government." The views, he said, expressed a year ago by this government are still valid today. The plan for political unification agreed to last February, Mr. Truman said, is sound. But he noted that the plan for military unification of all Chinese forces, agreed to last February, has been made difficult by the progress of the fighting since last April. And the president said, "China is a sovereign nation. We recognize that fact, and we recognize the national government of China." No Chinese will overlook the timing of the president's statement today, which followed by only a few hours a statement by two senators, one a Republican from Vermont and the other a Democrat from Montana, and signed also by four of this country's better-known experts on Sino-American and Russian-American relations. This statement notes that neither the Chinese government nor the communist can win a decisive military victory as things now stand. It suggests that if the Chinese can't settle their quarrel democratically, then an international conference be called within the framework of the United Nations to help them do it. Now, neither side in China can be expected to welcome this suggestion, for the simple reason that a settlement has been impossible all along, because both sides have been afraid to give in enough to make it possible, even with General Marshall on hand to reassure them. But the prospect is held out to the Chinese, in the senatorial statement today, that if they don't get together, they may have to see their own internal quarrel put in the hands of the United Nations, which would mean Russian-American consultations on China, among other things. There, of course, is no precedent for such a United Nations move. It would present an extremely knotty problem. For in this instance, the country in question is one of the big five that holds veto rights. The senatorial statement on the Chinese question arose out of a desire to use what is left of General Marshall's peace machinery to make a fresh start toward removing a threat to peace which hasn't removed itself. Such a fresh start is urgently needed to forestall the eruption of an internal stalemate into a general conflagration which inevitably would strain relations between this country and the Soviet Union. We often overlook the Far East. Now that the Japanese War is over, we look toward Europe when we think of the Russia of today. But it is in the Far East, in Manchuria, along the border that artificially separates Korea, yes, even in China itself, that we face the Soviet Union. The Chinese question is not an academic one. Its elimination, its solving, is vitally important to us today. President Truman declared also this afternoon that 1947 will be a prosperous year if there are no general business crippling strikes. But Truman stated at his news conference that he doesn't look for any business recession in the new year. And then he crisply asserted that not a single one of the strikes since the war ended was necessary. The president was asked what he thought of the economic outlook for 1947, and he replied without hesitancy and with vigor that the outlook is good and that it will continue to be good if people will stay on the job and work. He stated flatly that no one wants to see any strikes in 1947, and he emphasized that the fate of the country's economy depends on whether people are willing to work. White House correspondents pointed out that the Council of Economic Advisers in their report to the president today had conceded the possibility of a brief recession sometime in 1947. The president asked questioners why they thought there might be a recession. He said that while he had not read the report, he didn't concede any such thing. Mr. Truman said he would make specific recommendations in his economic report to Congress next month. This report will be based on data submitted to him by the council today. He declined to say anything about the recommendations before the report is submitted. The council said that while factors exist which might cause a recession next year, that it could be averted. The three-man group declared in its first report to the chief executive that business and employment should continue at a high level for several years to come. It stated that no prolonged recession is now in sight unless it's provoked by a mishandling of our economic affairs. Harold E. Stassen's bid of yesterday for the Republican presidential nomination is seen by politicians in Washington as an added spur to make the new Congress a proving ground for GOP hopefuls. Republicans, cocky over their landslide victory in last November's elections, are getting off to an almost unprecedented start in their scramble for the party's 1948 presidential nomination. Seasoned politicians declare that the session of Congress beginning January 3rd will be in large measure an elimination contest for the Republican National Convention, now about 18 months away. Most of the top names are members of Congress. All of them, save Stassen, are described as coy at the present time for strategical reasons. But politicians are quick to discover the presidential bug among their colleagues. They preview the incoming Congress as an acid test for presidential backers of Dewey, Bricker, Taft, Vandenberg, Stassen, Saltonstall, Warren, Lodge, Speaker to be Martin, and others considered to have something of a chance. The Governor Dewey intends to keep close tab on the doings in Congress, was construed from his conference at Albany today with many of the Republican legislators from New York State. That conference was billed as being for the purpose of closer cooperation between the federal and state governments. But it can be assumed that national politics were discussed. Mr. Stassen, in announcing his candidacy for the Republican presidential nomination yesterday, said that he would open offices in Washington January 1st and offer his aid to Republicans in Congress in shaping party legislation representing what he called true liberalism. The former Minnesota governor thus intends to keep in the political spotlight until the GOP convention. In making his far-ahead announcement of candidacy, Stassen is believed to have mapped strategy such as the late Wendell Willkie used to get the nomination in 1940. His was an appeal to the rank-and-file Republicans. Stassen simply formalized what political observers already knew, that he was running for the presidency. Opinion differs on whether his unorthodox announcement so long ahead of the convention is wise or unwise. Veteran observers suggest that he may have strengthened his race by his forthright announcement, while others considered receptive to the nomination refused to give a blunt yes to the question. There's more news to follow in just a moment. First, though, a word from Ernie Keller.
Everyone has agreed that America is in for the biggest sporting boom in history. Attendance figures promise to hit new highs as fans cheer their favorite stars and teams. One favorite seen at all sporting events the year-round, wherever men gather, is the always popular Florida Malba cigar. And there's ample reason. Malbas are smoking favorites because, like star athletes, they are consistent performers. Always pleasant, really satisfying to smoke. And like a winning team, Malbas gain more admirers daily because of a perfectly blended combination. Choice tobacco leaves specially treated to eliminate bite and give men a really mild smoke. If you aren't one of the Melba family already, try one the first chance you get. You're in for a smoking treat and a real surprise, too. Now back to Irving Waugh and the news.
In London, the House of Commons has voted 362-204 to nationalize Britain's railway system. Thus, the Parliament members have given a decisive second reading to the far-reaching transport bill, which has been under fire from Conservative members in 3 days of debate. The debate reached a climax tonight when Herbert Morrison, President of the Council, declared that nationalization would permit a bold and considered program of transport development. Concluding the case for the opposition, former Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden said that passage of the bill will be nothing less than a major national disaster. He added, the only economic justification for this bill is greater efficiency and lower cost, and we, the Conservatives, would like to be shown how this is going to be brought about. Eden described proposals for compensation of railway stockholders as confiscation of income for many who can ill afford it. The bill takes railroads, canals, harbors, and a large share of motor transport under the government's wing. Back in Washington, the fireworks popped right on schedule today when Edward P. Terry made his well-advertised appearance before the Senate committee investigating Senator Theodore Bilbo. Terry, the former secretary to the Mississippi senator, wound up an unhappy day on the witness stand, faced both with a contempt citation and possible perjury charges. The committee moved to cite Terry for contempt when he refused to tell to whom he had turned over $15,000, which had been collected to defeat Bilbo in the 1946 election. And the ugly word perjury came up when the committee directed that all of Terry's testimony be turned over to the Department of Justice with the object of a department ruling on a perjury citation. Terry, during today's session, objected to disclosing details of the $15,000 loan, which appeared in his regular bank account, because he said it would destroy his personal credit in New York, where he obtained the loan in 1945. At this point, Bilbo arose and said, well, you're ruining mine now. Terry, at the outset, tried to get out of testifying at all, but this motion of his attorney was promptly overridden. The former Bilbo secretary then went on to provide a number of sensations. The highlights were his charge that Bilbo's ex-campaign manager, A.B. Friend, had told him he would be killed if he testified against the senator. Friend promptly denied he had threatened Terry, but admitted that he might have said someone was on Terry's trail. Terry also said that he declared in 1945 that Bilbo was paid $1,500 for obtaining a narcotics prescription from the Federal Narcotics Bureau for a drug addict. Bilbo himself on a one-day postponement of his own session on the witness stand. He will testify tomorrow. Newberry County, South Carolina, is tense with sorrow tonight in the wake of a rail crossing accident in which the lives of 10 teenagers and their school bus driver were snuffed out by a Southern Railway passenger train this morning. 11 other children were injured in the collision or were on their way to classes, and a happy holiday spirit prevailed when the tragedy intervened. At school today, a pre-Christmas party was being planned. Some of the victims carried presents, which they intended to give fellow pupils in a schoolroom exchange of gifts. The wreck occurred shortly before 9 a.m., and it was late today before the victims had been identified, except for the bus driver. The passenger train came up on the crossing at nearly top speed, seeking to make up lost time. The engineer didn't see the bus approach the tracks until too late to brake his train. The passenger coaches came to a grinding stop several hundred yards beyond the crossing, leaving in their wake a scene of wreckage and horror. And now for the weather forecast for Mississippi and Alabama. Partly cloudy Thursday, moderate to fresh northerly winds on the coast, diminishing Thursday evening. And for Kentucky and Tennessee, fair, not so cold Thursday afternoon, Friday fair, and slightly warmer. And that's the news for right now.
It's always a pleasure to meet old friends, especially when you haven't seen them around for some time and you miss them. Well, that's what smokers are discovering now that Melba's are reappearing on cigar score counters all over America. For Melba's are mild, mellow, and have a fragrant aroma. Just what a man dreams of in a good cigar. No wonder Melba's have been an American favorite for more than 50 years. Remember the name, Melba, spelled M-E-L-B-A. We invite you to listen in again tomorrow evening at the same time to The World in Review. WSM Nashville. Now for Bulova Watch Time, Bulova on your wrist is on the air, faithful forever. Ladies, one of the most glorious Christmas gifts you can give a man is a Bulova watch, gift of a lifetime. Ask your jeweler to show you the new Bulova Excellency watches for gentlemen. They're actually years ahead in style, distinctively different in design. Surely no other Christmas gift is so thrilling to receive or is so treasured. So for Christmas, give him a Bulova Excellency watch. 21 jewels, priced from $52.50 to $225, including federal tax at Better Jewelers everywhere. It's exactly 10:15 p.m. BULOVA, Bulova Watch Time, courtesy Bulova Watch Company, 5th Avenue, New York.